conscious elimination of barriers to the development of virtuous forms of life. The rub was that the political and economic system that was designed by popular political economy constituted itself just such a barrier. And so we could begin with Proudhon, who was a French socialist who developed the idea of mutualism. Proudhon was actually the first to use the term scientific socialism, which was an attempt to build a bridge from the earlier notions of social science to the later forms of scientific socialism that are more commonly attributed to Marx. He also was the first to really highlight the importance of the class struggle, and this is woven into the history of the term mutualism. One of the first recorded uses of the term mutualism was actually in the 1820s, and was used in the New Harmony Gazette, and this is New Harmony as in the Owenite community in Indiana. So there is something of an Owenite heritage here, but it's unknown if there was a precedent for this usage in the Owenites in Britain itself. But where Proudhon adopted this term was from the name of a labor organization in France that he was associated with, and this was a free association of workers that I've also seen described as a secret society. But whether or not there was a connection between the Owenite mutualism and the mutualism of these militant workers is a completely other question. But so what put Proudhon on the map was his book that he published in 1840 titled What is Property? It's a prolonged critique of the conception of property as it's used in political economy. And everybody now knows the very presently cliched slogan, property is theft. When we go back to, what is property, we find that this notion that property is theft is but one part of a formula. It's followed by statements like property is liberty and property is impossible. This seems weird. What does Proudhon mean? And something that's often overlooked is that he was very familiar with the writings of Kant and actually was quite friends with, I believe, the first translator of Kant into French, and might have had access to these documents, these translations, prior to their publishing. And so what Proudhon was doing, he was constructing an antinomy that shows the internal problems of political economy, using the various philosophies of property that populated, economic discourse. One can justify property, and one can negate that justification. A consistent understanding of property cannot be reached through political economy. It is impossible. Marx was very initially enthused about Proudhon and his work. When Edgar Bauer, who was in Paris around the time that What is Property was published, criticized Proudhon, Marx and Engels responded to this in their 1844 work, The Holy Family. And this work included a series of comments on what is property. They write that all political economy takes private property for granted. And so they write that Proudhon makes a critical investigation, the first resolute, ruthless, and at the same time scientific investigation of the basis of political economy, that is private property. This is the great scientific advance he made, an advance which revolutionizes political economy, and for the first time makes a real science of political economy possible. And then this next quote is very important. It says, Proudhon's treatise, What is Property, is the criticism of political economy from the standpoint of political economy. Proudhon's treatise will therefore be scientifically superseded by a criticism of political economy, including Proudhon's conception of political economy. This work became possible only owing to the work of Proudhon himself, just as Proudhon's criticism has as its premise the criticism of the mercantile system by the physiocrats, Adam Smith's criticism of the physiocrats, Ricardo's criticism of Adam Smith, etc., etc. One of the things that Edgar Bauer critiqued Proudhon for was this idea of justice that is used throughout What is Property, eternal, non-historical or ahistorical force. Bauer wrote that Proudhon treats it as a god that guides mankind. And Marx is actually willing to forgive Proudhon for this, noting that relief from absolute history is the standpoint being developed in German philosophy. If it is not found in Proudhon's writings, it is only because he had the misfortune of being born a Frenchman, not a German. So, all in all, Marx affirms what is property. It demonstrates, on the basis of political economy itself, the failure of political economy to efficiently ground itself. There's two important points to take away. The first is that property is fundamentally about appropriation, but the form that appropriation takes place varies across history, and in this, Proudhon points the way towards a historicist method. And two, Proudhon has set in motion an overcoming of his own theoretical position, carrying out the critique of political economy from the basis of political economy opens the door towards the critique of political economy as such. So you have to ask, did this critique come? And it was kind of believed that Proudhon's next project, following What is Property, would be precisely this. And there is anticipation of his next book, which was The Philosophy of Poverty, published in 1846. It was thought to ultimately was going to achieve this goal. The book, as it stands, does have an interesting critique of monopoly. In this work, Proudhon sees monopoly as the primary problem, the barrier that to justice that generates poverty. He writes that monopoly has invaded everything: land, labor, and the instruments of labor, products and the distribution of products. Political economy has not been able to avoid admitting it. From the standpoint of monopoly, value is no longer the synthetic conception which serves to express the relation of a special object of utility to the sum total of wealth. Monopoly estimating things, not in their relation to society, but in their relation to itself, value loses its social character. It is nothing but a vague, arbitrary, egotistic, and essentially variable thing. So monopoly here is treated as a pollution of value. But here in Proudhon, what is value? And he takes up that kind of classical Aristotelian distinction between use value and exchange value as it's found across classical political economy. And he points towards something beyond it, what he calls constituted or absolute value. He understands absolute value in a very curious way. He treats use value and exchange value as contradictory, and absolute value is their hidden unity, a synthesis, a relationship of utility that is fixed by the labor that produces the commodity. And so the goal for mutualism is the true realization of value as unmolested by monopoly, the pure return of value, not beyond. This is effectively monopoly, you could say, creates usury where the price of a commodity is in far excess of its actual value. And so the question is, how do you realize absolute value? And Proudhon says, interestingly enough, through competition. And he has a very, very interesting quote here. He says, "Competition is necessary to the constitution of value, that is, to the very principle of distribution, and consequently to the advent of equality. As long as the product is supplied only by a single manufacturer, its real value remains a mystery, either through the producer's misrepresentation or through his neglect or inability to reduce the cost of production to its extreme limit. Thus, the privilege of production is a real loss to society, and publicity of industry, like competitions between laborers, a necessity. All utopias ever imagined or unimaginable cannot escape this law." So monopoly for Proudhon emerges on the basis of the absence of competition, which is a very accurate notion. You talk about things like a monopoly price. Monopoly or a cartel does set a price at a level that is detached from the price that would be realized in the basis of an unrestrained competitive behavior. But so for Proudhon, the solution to the social problem is simply to reestablish competition. And you can see here an affinity between him and what are called the Ricardian socialists. Because for the Ricardian socialists, Socialism was nothing more but allowing liberal political economy to actually be applied. This would be competition driving the price down to its cost of production. Or in other words, to put it in a William Petty type scenario, it would be the elimination of the political price and goods only trading at their nature price. Or as with Adam Smith, you would remove the nominal price and only have the real price. Or in Ricardo, you just basically have competition running until all the fluctuations of price above their cost of production are pushed downwards to that center of gravity, which we've already seen constituted by labor. So it makes sense in a way. Proudhon is looking at this, he's analyzing it, and he's wondering, how does labor get its just reward? And it's basically just to be fulfilled within the matrices of this competitive system. The other important point is that Proudhon considered competition and value as ahistorical. The philosophy of poverty does ultimately remain lodged within the framework of political economy. And it doesn't follow through with the broader critique of political economy that he himself had made possible with his book, What is Property? And so Marx, he responded in a year later in 1847 with his cheeky titled Poverty of Philosophy, which was a very extreme response to Proudhon. He charges Proudhon with, you know, basically this, a historical account that continues liberal political economy. It doesn't supersede it. It's not the attempt to overcome political economy, but an attempt to fix political economy, that justice, this eternal notion of justice, will be delivered if the contradictions internal to political economy are ultimately smoothed out. And so this failure to carry through the critique, and so it's very interesting when you compare the text of the Poverty of Philosophy to something later like Capital. Everything that's in Capital, you can find the germ seed of in the Poverty of Philosophy. I think it was the economist Joan Robinson who described the Poverty of Philosophy as basically a pure distilled version that gets diluted later by the overcomplication that is Capital. And this is important because the subtitle of Capital is the critique of political economy. But nonetheless, there's been a lot of people who have tried to defend Proudhon by pointing out similarities between his and Marx's ideas. Marx does also begin with use value and exchange value. And Marx also does point to a third kind of value that underscores both of these. But in contrast to Proudhon, what Marx is trying to do is demonstrate that value is transitory. It's historically bound. That the natural laws of capitalism are not ahistorical, eternal laws that have always been in motion. He wants to embed it within a very strict historical context. And so there's a same transitory social formation that generates both monopoly and competition. And both monopoly and competition aren't actually purely opposed to one another. Both are deeply implicated with one another on a fundamental level. But at the same time, so is value itself. The goal in the Marxian system isn't for the proletarian to receive the full value of their labor, because this is an incomprehensible notion. It's the elimination of these categories in total. So we can understand this conflict between Proudhon and Marx on Republican grounds. In Proudhon, the inability to truly realize value is the barrier to liberty and virtue, whereas in Marx, it is value itself that is the barrier. So insofar as Proudhon remains within the logic of value, he is trapped within this anti-Republican position. This becomes a little clearer as we look at some of Proudhon's writings in the 1850s, which go beyond just the focus on competition and pose the contract is essential. The contract becomes the binding element, a workers' association. And he has some interesting later still writings, I think in the 1860s, that begin to break with this a little bit, where his real interest is in forms of confederation. Curiously, for an anarchist, he talks about a proper way of forming a state. Starts to develop a lot of ideas that will actually receive an interesting echo when international relations start to become actual discipline. A lot of Marxists simply refuse to read Proudhon based on the critiques that Mark did, and I think this is actually kind of incorrect because there is a lot of interesting stuff that's happening in there, and it's also wildly influential, especially when we look American. Utopianism drew very heavily on Proudhon. But also because I think that both Marx and Marxism as a whole remain kind of haunted by Proudhon in a lot of ways. And you can even see in Marx's critique of the Gotha Program, which is a document that outlines how he thinks the transition from capitalism to something beyond capitalism follow out, you find a lot of ideas that emerge in Proudhon, but they're modified, but I think that they're there. That's ultimately digression, I think. But it's worth asking what exactly is value for Marx. He makes some important modifications to existing political economy to underscore it, and he tries to illustrate it as something historically specific. And the first thing he does is there's a divergence between labor, which he, you know, we can understand as physical expenditure, and between that and something he calls labor power. And labor power appears to have been borrowed from von Helmholtz, who used it in relation with the sort of heat machine universe paradigm we talked about in the cybernetic episode, where labor power is this cosmological capacity to do work, a universal reservoir of energy. And this is similar to how Marx uses it, not exactly. In Marx, labor power is the potential to do labor, to do physical expenditure, but it's not equivalent to it. The capacity to do it is the potential. And it's very important, you know, we can't run away with a metaphor in this context because Marx and Engels disavow multiple times attempts to ground their theories in thermodynamics. It seems to be metaphorical borrowing that's supposed to remain a metaphor. But what the worker is forced to sell under capitalism in exchange for the wage isn't their labor directly, but their labor power, their capacity to do labor. The labor power itself is a commodity. The price of labor power is the wage. The wage is the cost. And so here at the beginnings of a historically bound understanding, because it's a matter of historical record, that the buying and selling of labor power only exist under particular conditions. And the next bit that he does is something closely related to this, which is the distinction between concrete and abstract labor. Concrete labor is more in line with labor as physical expenditure. It's the act of creation of use values. But abstract labor is labor abstracted from its qualities. It's pure quantity, sums of emptied out labor power. And there's a historical specificity to this, which Marx outlines as early as the German ideology, where he writes that, quote, labor, not only as a category, but in reality, has become a means to create wealth in general, and has ceased to be tied as an attribute to a particular individual. This state of affairs is most pronounced in the United States, the most modern form of bourgeois society. This category, abstract labor, labor as such, labor sans phrase, thus becomes a practical fact only there. This simple abstraction, which plays a decisive role in modern political economy, an abstraction which expresses an ancient relation existing in all social formations, nevertheless appears to be actually true in this abstract form only as a category of the most modern society. In Capital Volume 1, he describes abstract human labor as the substance of value, and capital itself as value presenting itself as self-moving substance, undergoing transformation into different forms in accordance with the continually expanding reproduction of the capitalist system. This here is political economy taken to its furthest extreme, right to its own point of overcoming, where on the one hand we can no longer take its laws and devices as something eternal moving in the world as a force. On the other hand, you also begin to understand the elements that must be dislodged to get beyond this particular historical paradigm. And so if we're, you know, talking about the Marxist project in relation to the Republican tendency, this would be, in those terms, exactly where the Republican project restarts itself.
Inside.
For clothes that Tristan loves. At Bold 3 Detergent Plus Fabrics offer.
Spray. Relief.
You two take care of labor.
Only intended for a playing cat.
You don't want to die of cold. Toll free.
Nails and more nails.
You handsome, charming, specially marked boxes of monster cereals, no. Inside one of these free wax lips, fangs, or mustaches, they just uncover the real you.
We now continue with Smurf.
Funky colors. Shapes that swing.
It's impossible.
I came a level being teen and it is virtually.
After the honeymoon, but when I got back and I found out that he'd stolen Ben.
Lies have gotten all of us into so much trouble.
We'll return after these messages.
I know, but I feel like you must literally be working around the clock, right? Like, are you sleeping?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's not that bad.
Okay.
It just, this one's going to be really good, so I'm glad that we can...
I know, I'm super excited to listen to it. I like how this one's also really expanded. You included Logo and your wife, and developing like an all-star cast here.
Well, there's just so much to it, because it connects in all these weird ways, you know?
As most things do, as we've been finding out.
Because there's like that nexus there. Because you know how Murawski is saying, just focusing on the scientific metaphor and the connection there between the economics and these physical theories. But it's like when you go back into that critical period in the Restoration, you have the organism coming out. You have corpuscularism. You have society being formed and all these private societies and associations and clubs. And then you have economics coming out of that. And you also have Leibniz and Locke debating about essences and metaphysical substance and universal language. It's like all these things are part and parcel with the same kind of...
Do you go into corpuscularism?
Yeah, I did.
Badass.
Well, because that's even the same thing, isn't it? About building up the economy. It's like now we're dealing with atoms being built up into complex matter. It's like it's literally the same fucking thing.
It's fucking cool. I'm so excited. It's, you know, if there was podcast Oscars, you know, this would be up there. I don't see Chapo Trap House doing anything like this.
I have never listened to it, so I can't even.
I've never listened to it either. All I know is that they, you know, did their own knockoff Watergate.
Yeah, I kind of want to go listen to that just because I want to know what bullshit they said.
I just don't. Maybe I'll do it during my trail run tomorrow.
I found a really good Munn quote, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You're gonna like that.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to know more about Munn.
He was like the driving force that made it so that the East India Company became an established institution. Like, he's the one who came in at the very early stage when it was not clear whether or not it was going to actually be a real thing and survive its early crises. But then, you know, he's the one who saw it through.
Oh, cool. Yeah, because, you know, I found the thing that, like, linked him kind of with Hobbes and kind of argued, I think, that Hobbes was driving a lot of his stuff from Munn. But I was going back and I was looking, you know, through our conversation, and it's an element that I'm so fascinated in because it's a person that we've talked about before, which is A.A. Carnot, who is a French mathematician and engineer. And the reason we had talked about him before was because Arnold Galen, the German sociologist, he identified Carnot as the person who introduced the idea of post-history. And even though, like, Carnot doesn't really spell it out, he talks about, like, history no longer kind of unfolding, but it's very regimented and planned, you know, like a very scientific society based on, you know, mathematical principles. But when you kind of dig into the history of neoclassical economics, turns out, like, when we talk about Walras, like Leon Walras, he is directly, like, descending from Carnot, because Walras's father, August Walras, was, by some accounts, he was Carnot's like a schoolmate, but in other accounts, he was like Corneau was his teacher. And so Corneau had all these ideas about kind of transforming transforming economics into something properly scientific, more grounded in mathematics. And this is coming, you know, from a very engineering background. So it's kind of like sweeping, you know, the engineering perspective, kind of imposes its own worldview, on things and kind of reassesses them from that perspective. And so Corneau wants to do that with mathematics or with economics. And then August Walras gets that from him and passes it on to his son, Leon Walras, who originally wanted to be a novelist or, you know, a man of letters, a literary figure. But he convinced Leon, like, no, you don't do that. You know, carry on this dream that my buddy Corneau, you know, started, and finally make economics into a science proper. And so I found that to be a really fascinating little trajectory there.
Yeah, there's these dynasties. Like, who would have fucking thought that there was these neoclassical dynasties running through this period of economics? It's actually one of the things that I talked about before. What's really interesting is just the Berlin University and their engineering schools and how that's sort of like, I feel like that's a missing piece of the puzzle historically.
Yeah.
Because like you're saying with Corneau, he has this idea about post-history. History is so bound up in economic thinking. They go hand in hand in so many ways where, for example, a lot of the moral arguments that drive the formation of classical economics, it's based around ancient historical scholarship that people like Hume are doing. Like Hume does a paper he writes about whether or not ancient nations were more or less populous than the present time. Because at that time in the early 18th century, it was widely believed or claimed by certain people that in antiquity there were more people than there were in the 18th century, and that, you know, man had progressively fallen and, you know, the population had dwindled and that there was fewer people now. And
I love that. Yeah, the anti-Malthus.
But that's what motivated a lot of the scholarship that was done into ancient history. That was what motivated Gibbon. That's the sort of thing that he was responding to, and to the problems, the corruption of the ancient Greeks, of Athens. You know, these are the questions that we're concerned with: is did philosophy and intellectualism corrupt the Athenians? Or that's their whole frame of reference, and they were trying to do all this scientific historical study with a strong textual basis in order to prove one way or another on these questions, which had these very important economic implications.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, it works really well because, you know, we talk about political economy, you know, as this unity, but it's in neoclassical economics where you kind of have this divergence, the separation of the political and the economy into separate spheres. And so it's fascinating that when you can talk about like neoclassical economics and the notion of post-history itself having kind of like a common fountain in a way, it's almost like the notion of post-history works directly in tandem with the starting of the separation of these spheres, which, you know, starts to break apart all the concerns that were previously interwoven through classical economics.
Yeah, and it's so unavoidable too, because this is the context in which the neoclassical school basically accomplishes that move of separating economics away from the political, away from the national economy. They drive a wedge between those two things, and they pull out the economic theory as its own separate thing, its own pure thing. And that's one of the ways they accomplished that is that the leader of the Austrian school of economics,
mm-hmm,
Karl Menger, and he's also a part of a dynasty too, right?
Oh, I don't know too much about who, like.
No, he is. He is.
What's the Menger dynasty?
It's also Karl Menger.
Oh, sneaky.
One is spelled with a C, one is spelled with a K, actually, so.
Oh, man. I wonder, now I'm wondering how much I, like, you know, looked at both of those and thought they were the same person. Because I have seen both spellings, but I didn't realize that they were separate people. Oh, man.
These bloodlines run deep, I tell you. But